The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading selections from Our State magazine. August brings us Our State magazine's Back to School issue and features articles about the folks who've shaped and been shaped by a North Carolina education. And first up is the welcome message entitled How I Write by the editor, Elizabeth Hudson. First came my name, formed with a fat, husky pencil that I gripped in my fist, bearing down so hard that Elizabeth remained etched in the paper even after the letters were erased. Then came cursive, my number two pencil, imitating the long rows of loops and humps strung across the top of the third grade chalkboard. And then, in ninth grade, typing, wrists curved and fingertips lightly resting on the home row keys, ASDF, JKL, semicolon, of an IBM Selectric, with the promise that from those eight characters, my hands would somehow find all the others. I've accumulated plenty of writing tools since then, blackwing pencils with their soft leads, leather journals, drawers full of gel pens that glide across paper. On my desk sits a MacBook and an iPad. I've spent most of my life learning how to put words to paper, and still, the blank page gets me every time. This one, page 8, has been waiting all morning. I type a sentence, delete it, move a word, change a verb. Sentences appear and disappear until I finally push away from my desk and go into the kitchen. Here is how I write. I pull eggs from the refrigerator, sugar from the cabinet. I might make a chess pie, the one my grandmother made, or, on the days when the words seem farthest away, an apple pie, something that takes longer. I roll the crust from the middle out just like she did. Sometimes I fry okra, cutting each pod into small green wheels and shaking them with cornmeal in a paper sack. Or I might make my dad's lasagna, laying the noodles edge to edge in a casserole dish, or his spaghetti sauce, the one he simmered for hours in a 12-quart aluminum stock pot. I chop the onion slowly, reducing it to a small, even dice, imitating the precision of his hand, his care with the knife. I wish I'd watched more closely. I wish I'd asked about extra oregano, how he knew when the sauce had cooked long enough. But standing at the stove, I can almost hear him, the shuffle of his L.L. Bean moccasin slippers, the wooden spoon knocking against the rim of the pot. I can see him pinch off a few browned crumbles of beef, hold them till they're cool, and then to offer them to our dog. There you go, girl, he'd say. And there I am at the kitchen table, homework spread around me, one of my dad's sharpened crossword pencils in my hand. He stirs the sauce. Now in my own kitchen, I stir too. The familiar motion occupies my hands and lets my mind reach back. A forgotten phrase surfaces, a scene I had not known I carried. When I sit down again, I read the sentences out loud, listening for the people who are no longer visible in the room, wondering whether they can hear me anyway. I place my hands on the keys and press down, writing their voices on the page, hoping the imprint remains. And now I will take you on a descriptive journey through this month's photo essay entitled Spirit Section, Legendary Traditions and Unwavering Allegiances Prove Rooting for the Home Team is a North Carolina Sport. The first page we have from Jim Valvano's championship season to today's revelry at Chapel Hill, Duke, and Wake Forest, North Carolina fans know how to cheer their schools to victory. And we've got a Cameron Crazies on the left with their faces painted dark blue and just acting crazy. And then in the section following, you've got it looks around the student union, and actually it's up on Franklin Street. You see a wave of Carolina blue, people celebrating some victory. Good times. We've got a picture of Krzyzewskiville, population 1422 at Duke University, looking out over the tent, Krzyzewskiville, the tent city. And then we've got a couple of cheerleaders from East Carolina University in their purple and gold. We've got Appalachian State University in their orange and black and yellow, or yeah. And we've got NC State, a black and white picture of the wolf pulling the NC State big drum. We've got Women's College, University of North Carolina. That's what is now UNC Greensboro. A picture of that yellow and or a mustard color and white. We've got North Carolina A&T with the majorettes pointing their batons and in their classic pose. And we have a picture of Ramesses, a black and white picture of Ramesses representing the UNC Chapel Hill. It says, "Let's go Carolina beat Georgia in the 1947 Sugar Bowl." We've got a Wake Forest University with their streaming toilet paper across the campus. Good times. Were you there in 1986 when Krzyzewskiville was founded by students determined to get tickets to the Duke-UNC men's basketball game? Or when Lobo 3, seen with Lloyd Rawls of Fayetteville and Chris Coltrane of Madison, when Coltrane was the mascot for NC State? When Lobo 3, a wolf, was the mascot for NC State. So many priceless memories involve our state's colleges and the fans who rally for them. Head over heels. UNC Chapel Hill. Every day is a great day to be a Tar Heel at Shrunken Head Boutique, a North Carolina institution since 1969. Owners Matt and Melissa Pate stock the gear fans need to root for their heels on the field or the court. And they've got their family outside and on Franklin Street, Shrunken Head Boutique. And look inside the store with some Carolina gear. The Carolina blue Chevy in the back of the tailgate, Shrunken Head's boutique expansion space along Franklin Street inspires fans to level up their pregame party. And so it is the back end tailgate of a Chevy, and it has a picture above that of the field at Keenan Stadium. And a carpet on the ground that's looks reminiscent of a football field with a touchdown in each end. All sorts of Carolina gear. Fantasy football, Appalachian State University in Boone. Football is more than a game at App State. It's an all-day celebration as the Blue Ridge Mountains keep watch over elaborate tailgates, festive tents, and dedicated fans. The thrilling atmosphere is only made more exhilarating when the Mountaineers carry the pigskin into the end zone. On crisp fall Saturdays, more than 31,000 fans sporting black and gold file into Kid Brewer Stadium, known as The Rock, to cheer on their Mountaineers. And we have a bunch of fans posing for the picture and an aerial view of the stadium, the Mountaineers stadium in Boone, filled with revelers. Ahoy, victory! East Carolina University in Greenville. With each heart-stopping play during an autumn evening of pirate football, shouts of purple are answered by roars of gold. This colorful chant, an ECU tradition, begins as fans make their way into Dowdy Ficklin Stadium through a sea of tailgaters and continues until there's a victory on the board. And we got a couple of fans who are decked out in full purple face paint and smiling for the cameras, and some cheerleaders raising their bullhorns with ECU on it. Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze rings throughout the stadium as East Carolina's football team, raring to meet its opponent, storms through a giant inflatable pirate skull pouring smoke. And we have the mascot, the pirate, with a sword in one hand and a pistol in the other hand, dressed in pirate gear. Pack and a punch. North Carolina State University in Raleigh. A glittering display of fireworks punctuates a day of celebrating all things Wolfpack at NC State's Packapalooza. Every August, students, faculty, alumni, and of course, Mr. and Mrs. Wolf Gather at this all-day street festival packed with live music and family-friendly activities. And we have a picture of Mr. and Ms. Wolf in their gear looking out at the crowd. And we have a picture on the Memorial Bell Tower is bathed in a red light. More than 90,000 fans cap off Wolfpack Welcome Week at Packapalooza. Even the Memorial Bell Tower gets in the action, glowing Wolfpack red. And there's some fireworks going off in that picture as well. Waiting Game, Duke University, Durham. What began as a practical way to ward off the elements has since morphed into a rite of passage for students at Duke. 40 years ago, Kim Reed and her friends pitched several tents outside Cameron Indoor Stadium in 28-degree weather to secure tickets to the Duke-UNC men's basketball game. Others followed suit, and Krzyzewskiville was born. And we have a picture on the small insert here of Krzyzewskiville, marker there with the Duke mascot, Duke Blue Devil mascot, leaning his elbow on there. And showing a picture of that first tent, beginnings of Krzyzewskiville. Nothing showcases Duke devotion like the rainbow of tents sprouting up in Krzyzewskiville during basketball season. Cameron Crazies stake their claim weeks in advance to secure entry to the beloved Duke-UNC men's rivalry game. Looking down from an aerial photo outside Cameron, there's a plethora, a rainbow of tents that was mentioned in the article. Some shelters and tents mostly, though. Small tents and big tents awaiting the chance to get their tickets. Honor Roll. Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem. Ribbons of tissue stream from red maple trees after a jubilant evening on Herm Plaza at Wake Forest. Known as the Quad, this space becomes a waterfall of white after athletic triumphs and academic achievements, a tradition marked since the 1950s by rolls and rolls and rolls of toilet paper. And we've got a photo of the in front of one of the buildings in the Quad, trees covered in toilet paper, and an aerial view of that same building from afar. Again, with trees and the ground covered in toilet paper and a myriad of people, students in the background on the Quad. Revving the engine of his signature black and gold motorcycle, the Demon Deacon spins into Allegacy Stadium, Federal Credit Union Stadium, amid fanfare as the Wake Forest football team charges the field. And we have a picture of that, of the Demon Deacon on his motorcycle powering into the stadium. Through some fire and smoke. Stepping out. NC Agricultural and Technical State University, NCA&T, in Greensboro. Aggieland bursts with admiration during the greatest homecoming on earth, a week-long festival drawing more than 130,000 back to NCA&T each year. For the past century, students and alumni have gathered for grand pageantry and the coronation of Mr. and Miss A&T. The powerful sound and high-stepping choreography of the blue and gold marching machine announce the arrival of fall in Greensboro. And we have a picture of the a tuba player at the beginning, and it's a beautiful, shiny tuba player. And it's on the inside of the rim of the horn. It says North Carolina A&T, black and gold marching machine. And they're in their gold and blue and white uniforms. And then on the facing page, we've got Mr. and Miss A&T crowned on a float with the court. Blaze of Glory. UNC Greensboro, back in Greensboro, of course. 100 wooden pallets and 10 bales of pine straw erupt into a symbol of school spirit, ushering in homecoming at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Spartan fans gather at their bonfire and fuel an evening of music and dancing. At UNCG's homecoming bonfire at Kaplan Commons, flames rise as high as the rooftop of Elliott University Center. And there's a perimeter around this bonfire so folks cannot get hurt, and there's many people observing this fire that's just building higher and higher in the photograph. In the facing page, we have some of the Spartan cheerleaders performing a move. Well, we'll kick off the theme. Our first article in the theme of school days or back to school is called Sounding Off. A writer revisits a classroom rite of passage to see why so many musical journeys begin with a squeak. For nearly half an hour, the fourth grade students at Kara Furness's music class have played their plastic recorders more or less in unison, an enthusiastic ensemble squeaking and squawking to their heart's content, and to their teacher's ears, discontent. They've found safety in numbers, satisfied that no matter how loudly they play or how far off key they stray, their terrible toots will remain anonymous, buried in a sea of equally disharmonious efforts. With so many clinkers clinking at once, they reason not even Furness, who's been teaching the instrument for more than two decades, can detect individual culprits. But now, even though it's only the students' first day of recorder lessons at Moorhead Elementary School in Greensboro, Furness wants him to perform solo so she can better gauge how they're doing individually. Are their fingers fully covering the holes on their instruments, producing a clean melodic tone? Are they blowing too hard? As Furness well knows, a mighty blast from a fourth grader's lungs can turn the simplest note into a shriek. This is not to embarrass you, she assures the class. I just want to hear you play by yourself, and if you squeak, who cares? The whole class, that's who. Each student's musicianship, or lack thereof, is about to be laid bare for the other kids to hear, judge, and snicker at. One by one, the students take turns playing the three notes they've learned so far, B, A, and G. Not a song or even a rhythm, just the individual notes. The results are exactly what Furness expects. A scant few kids play their notes perfectly, while the other 20-plus wannabe musicians struggle, unleashing a string of squeaks, squawks, and squeals. Predictably, a few of their classmates giggle, until Furness shushes them with that stern look teachers are born with. Then, time after time, she patiently points out what her young musicians are doing wrong, gently transforming their sour notes into sweeter ones. Yes, dude, she exclaims when a student gets it right. Way to go! Finally, only one soloist remains, one last opportunity for either musical mastery or misery. And 25 students eagerly turn to gawk at the biggest kid in the class. Me. You remember the recorder, right? It's the flute-like instrument that so many North Carolina children learned to play in elementary school. While it has been around since the Middle Ages, it wasn't until the 20th century that the instrument became an institution in our state's classrooms. Music historians say the growth of plastic injection molding in the 40s and 50s allowed for the mass production of plastic recorders, and companies began selling them by the truckload to school districts all over the country, sometimes for as little as a dollar apiece. By the early 60s, they were commonplace in classrooms. It's not clear exactly when recorders first reached North Carolina schools, but countless Tar Heels have memories of excitedly producing their first notes in third, fourth, or fifth grade. For many of them, it was the first and perhaps only musical instrument they ever learned to play. My initial go-round with the recorder was in the early 70s as a fourth grader at N.B. Mills Elementary School in Statesville. I remember the thrill, be it ever so shrill, of my first note. I remember practicing in my bedroom with the door closed at my parents' insistence. As I improved, they attended several of my impromptu living room concerts and managed not to roll their eyes when I performed Hot Cross Buns and Mary Had a Little Lamb ad nauseum. I dreamed of stardom. In retrospect, teenage girls were never going to shell out their hard-earned babysitting bucks to hear me play Born Free or When the Saints Go Marching In at a sold-out arena, but I didn't know that at that time. My only public performance was a fourth-grade concert in the school auditorium. Not sure what we played, but I'm guessing it wasn't a banger. Maybe My Country, 'Tis of Thee, another school across town, Northview Elementary, had its own recorder consort that performed at local churches and nursing homes, but not us. In more recent years, the instrument has lost some of its prominence in the elementary classrooms, according to Brandon Reeder, who oversees music standards for the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. Although some schools still teach the humble recorder, many have replaced it with the ukulele or lap dulcimer, he explains. In my first 6 years of teaching, I taught recorder, but then I was done with the squeaking and squawking and I switched to the ukulele, Reeder says. I taught music because I wanted students to be able to enjoy music as adults. I was trying to foster that lifelong independent musicianship. So the question becomes, how many adults do you know that play the recorder on a regular basis versus playing the ukulele or the guitar for fun? Retired Guilford and Moore County's teacher Bernie Hall, who taught music full-time and still teaches as a substitute, says he hears that sentiment often. The recorder has been mercilessly mocked on social media. It gets mentioned on posts like, things I learned in school that I've never used in real life. It gets a bad rap, and in reality, it's for some kids a great precursor to band. In fact, many of our state's students got an early taste of that band experience when groups like North Carolina Symphony put on educational concerts and invited the young musicians to perform a piece or two with the orchestra. The kids would practice and then play with the orchestra at their concert hall, says. It was a really big deal. Of course, before students were allowed to play with the orchestra, they had to advance beyond hot cross buns. That's where those brave music teachers come into play, risking their ears and sanity to teach the recorder. It's not for the faint of heart, Hall acknowledges. It can be very hard on the ears. Elementary music specialist Janine DeMond, who's taught recorder at Northern Elementary in Greensboro for 19 years, agrees. Playing the recorder is a rite of passage at our school, but it's very messy and loud, she says. Parents don't even want to hear it at first. They'll send me videos of their kids out on the back porch practicing. Oh, the neighbors must love that. Ironically, Kara Furness, whose class I've chosen to sit in on, does essentially the same thing to her neighbors, leaving her room door open so nearby classes can hear every note. It's fun for them to hear it, Furness claims. They don't complain, but sometimes they'll come and quietly shut my door. Furness, who began teaching the instrument in 2004, may be North Carolina's biggest recorder fan, enthusiastically praising it as a fun and useful tool for teaching children music. She has recorder-themed T-shirts. One of them reads, Peace, Love, Recorder, and even recorder-shaped earrings. During the pandemic, she sent photos of herself playing the instrument to inspire her students, everything from Yellow Submarine and YMCA to Meet the Flintstones. Every year when new students take up the recorder, Furness relishes the first day of lessons almost as much as the students do. After 22 years of teaching, though, she knows to brace herself for those first notes she's going to hear. Kids think you have to blow as hard as you can to make a sound, she says, so the first sound they make will be loud and squeaky. And frankly, the sounds may get worse before they get better, but they will get better, she promises. In the meantime, the kids have a blast. It's so awesome to look out and see them having a good time, she says. There's so much about school that's hard for kids, and music gives them a chance to be successful, and that's great. Some of them might struggle elsewhere, but they come in my class and they thrive. Which brings us back to this fourth grade introductory class where I've volunteered to humiliate myself. The moment has finally arrived for me to show what I've learned, or what I haven't learned, in a solo performance. In half an hour, Furness has showed us how to hold the recorder when we're playing and when we're not. She's pointed out that the thumb hole on the back and the seven other holes on the front, explaining that we have to cover them fully to avoid producing, quote, a wacko sound. She's also shown us how to blow gently into the instrument so our notes sound more like melodic bird calls than shrieking factory whistles. I'll admit, I'm a tad nervous when Furness asks Mr. Jimmy to play the notes for her. A longtime church choir member, I've sung solos in front of hundreds without passing out, but somehow this feels a bit different. My hands have begun to sweat ever so slightly, and the recorder feels like a slippery eel. With the eyes of 25 students watching me intently, eager to unleash their sneeriest snickers, I timidly play the three notes, holding each a tad longer than I should. B, B-A-G. No squeaks, squawks, or squeals. The little girl to my left offers a polite golf clap, and a few other students join in. Furnish grins and says, "They're proud of you, Mr. Jimmy." Well, they're not the only ones. Suddenly, I'm in fourth grade again, dreaming of the possibilities. Hot cross buns, anyone? To round out our episode, we'll fit in a few of the Tar Heel time capsules from across the state. This is called the North Carolina Project. Across North Carolina and beyond, binders stowed away in attics preserve memories of North Carolina projects. Assigned by teachers from the mountains to the coast, no true projects turned out alike. But whether the students now live across the country or a few miles from their childhood deck classrooms, many trace their appreciation for our state back to those formative school lessons. This is called A Cut Above by Anne Cobgood in Winston-Salem from 1956. My best ever teacher, Doug Carter at Calvin H. Wiley Elementary School, had very high expectations for all of us, Anne Hobgood says. I knew I had to go the extra mile with my project. So she traced North Carolina's curves onto paper, a template for her dad, Fambro, to cut from the wood before she burned icons emblematic of North Carolina into the cover. Her project swivels open to reveal pages of her own hand-drawn design and annotations, along with pictures from Variety Vacation Land. My mother cut the shapes of the pages for me because my left hand was terrible with right-handed scissors, Anne recalls. And so we've got a couple of samples here. We have the project that's the wooden shape of North Carolina. It's got a Cape Hatteras on the coast. It's got Kerala, or the Wright Brothers Memorial on the right. It's got a peanut in the middle. It's got a chair down near the south. It's got pine trees up near the mountains. And then inside, she's got different things. She's got pages that represent each part of the state. You've got seagulls and Cape Hatteras on the coast, and Wright Brothers Memorial again in color on one of the pages, and laying out at the beach. We've got a forester cutting down a tree in the mountains, and we've got rushing water, and looks like a plant of some sort of barn. Yeah, interesting. And then she's got the state motto up here. She's got a picture of a cardinal and a dogwood reflected. We'll pick up next episode with more of the School Days episode, but that music means that we've come to the end of our time today for this episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join me next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.